Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. That war came home to America again yesterday with an attack on innocent civilians in New York City by a man of Uzbek origin in this country as a result of a bizarre program called the Diversity Lottery. He has murdered 8, as best we can tell. Some 11 or 12 others have been badly wounded. And to discuss not only this incident, but to try to help make sense of what it's about and why it is continuing to happen here, as well as elsewhere, and why it is entirely likely, all other things being equal, that it will happen again, and probably with even more horrific consequences, is our regular guest at about this time each week, Diana West, one of the most thoughtful and, I think, courageous analysts of the challenges of our time. You can find her writings these days at dianawest.net. She has been a longtime syndicated columnist and best-selling author of 2 terrific books, very much relevant to the present topic, Death of the Grown-Up and American Betrayal. Diana West, it's so good to have you with us to help make sense, if we can, of what has just happened and what we had best do to try to prevent it from happening again. Welcome back.
Thank you, Frank.
I'd like to talk with you about a concept, Diana, that I think is at the core of this. We don't know a lot about the individual, but this perpetrator apparently shouted Allahu Akbar, the cry of the jihadists, particularly in the process of martyring themselves, killing others. I think the term is submission. It is, of course, the literal meaning of the word Islam. But I'm interested in your thoughts as to whether, as I think, what we're witnessing here and elsewhere in the free world is the fruit of decades now, really, of at least implicitly the practice of non-Muslim submission to these Sharia supremacists. What are your thoughts on that?
It certainly is the beginning of our shock and awareness of being under attack as far as the beginning goes. And from that beginning, we have been censoring ourselves on the full, frank, honest, and investigatory discussion of Islam, the institution of jihad, the purpose of jihad, which is to make the world submit to Islam, and what that means when Muslim immigration is bringing Islam along with jihadists, along with jihad, all across the previously Christian, post-Christian Western world, Judeo-Christian world. So this is the crux of the problem, that we have essentially strangled ourselves and our understanding of what is happening to us, which is why when this awful attack yesterday happened in New York City, the FBI, even with a man shouting Allahu Akbar, according to witnesses, the FBI actually put out a statement saying it was too early to determine whether the incident is terror-related. And I have that in a screenshot from television. So, I mean, this was a truth statement. Unbelievable.
Even as the mayor of New York City, who has probably done as much as anybody to weaken the city's defenses against this sort of thing, was declaring it terrorism.
And this is because of the training in submission, the training in, of course, we should probably be discussing the term dhimmitude, which goes back to the historian Bat Yor's understanding of the behavior of non-Muslims under the influence of Islamic law, under the fear of Islamic law, before a country is Islamized.
Is actually conquered.
actually conquered and truly under this law, the behavior is of the dhimmi, those who live under Islamic law by sufferance.
Now, Diana, one of the things that I've taken away from all of this has been that when the Sharia supremacists, for want of a better term, the jihadists, perceive the infidel behaving as a dhimmi or otherwise submitting to them out of fear, perhaps, or a misplaced belief that if only they're accommodating, they're demonstrating their diversity, that they'll behave less badly, these jihadists. But in fact, the doctrine of Sharia, the Quran, commands that you must make them feel subdued when you see them behaving in a submissive fashion. How is that factoring into this? And I'd ask you specifically to talk a little bit, if you would, about the Muslim Brotherhood.
Well, I think the best way to describe that is it's working according to plan. It's working according to it's working as it has always worked. This formula for conquest. This is why it is so important to study the history, not just of any one country, but of all the countries that previous to their Islamic conquest had a multiplicity of religions and ethnicities and cultures. When we first saw the Buddhas of Bamiyan dynamited by the Taliban, I remember I was actually charged. I was a Washington Times editorial writer, and I was given the task of commenting on this. And frankly, and honestly, I didn't really know what I was looking at. But this was an opportunity to learn. I mean, it looked like just wholesale destruction for no reason. But of course, there is a reason. And the reason is to destroy what came before. And this is why we see attacks on cultural sites. You know, at the Louvre, we saw the Louvre attack, was it last year? I mean, this is not something just out of the sky. There are formula here. And the Muslim Brotherhood is an engine of this same doctrine, a very organized one, a very financed one.
And we actually know a lot about it, if only we have the wit to look for it, notably in the explanatory memorandum that is the secret plan of the Brotherhood for conquering this country. And Diana, one other aspect of this, which I think is so central to what we do about this, and whether if we fail to act, we're going to see this become a vastly bigger problem, is the Brotherhood has been putting into place as part of their domination of the Muslim community in this country. I personally don't believe that all Muslims want to live under Sharia or want to force the rest of us to submit to it. But the Brotherhood for sure does, and they're starting with their own community. They're building mosques and other infrastructure across the country, and mosques, let's be clear, are sort of multi-use facilities that have, among other purposes, in many cases, at least under these jihadists, the training and recruiting and enabling of some of these who are prepared to go out and act murderously as well as use a more stealthy kind of jihad. But is it important to your way of thinking, Diana, that we be not only surveilling, but where we find evidence of this kind of, well, seditious behavior at best and at worst, pre-violent behavior, we shut these sorts of institutions down? We undo this kind of infrastructure in America.
Absolutely. I mean, this is a situation where, frankly, until there is reciprocity whereby churches can go up in Mecca, I think it's a good idea not to permit mosques to come up here. I mean, this is a situation where, yes, this becomes an important organizing structure for the actual jihadists involved. And yes, the fact of Muslims who are not engaged in violence is, of course, part of the panoply of Islam. However, this is where I think Noni Darwish's just sheer brilliance cuts through in terms of understanding those are the Muslims who tolerate the violence of their society. That's how just over the centuries this has accrued. And what she fears and sees happening in the West is that the rest of us, non-Muslims, are becoming moderate Muslims in the sense of tolerating the violence, tolerating the repression. And that is the most dangerous thing. That is the most dangerous thing when we become the moderate Muslims.
It's an interesting concept. I'm not sure whether it's more accurate than describing us as dhimmis or not, but whichever it is, if we persist in it, we're going to see them making redoubled efforts to make us feel subdued. Dinah West, we have to leave it at that. We are hard out of time. Thank you so much for all that you do. Check out her great work at dinahwest.net. We'll talk with you again next week, Dinah. Daniel Horowitz joins us next. We'll be discussing, among other things, all of this and the judicial tyranny that is contributing to it in this country. That and more, straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. It is a delight to say we are joined by Daniel Horowitz, one of the rising, really luminous, bright stars in the conservative firmament, as far as I'm concerned. Incredibly thoughtful, extraordinarily articulate, and increasingly, fortunately, influential with respect to his analyses of the challenges of our time. He is the author, among other things, of a fantastically important book about which we will be talking momentarily, Stolen Sovereignty: How to Stop Unelected Judges from Transforming America. You can also follow his writings at, among other places, Conservative Review. Daniel Horowitz, welcome back. It is so good to have you.
Great to be with you. I wish it could be under better circumstances and better news.
Well, me too. But if it were so, it would be for lesser men to be trying to make sense of it all and do something about it. So here we are. Daniel Horowitz, let me ask you first and foremost for your thoughts about the attacks of yesterday, and not only what you know they are about in their own right, but what they portend.
Sure. I mean, there's one thing that's important here, and that is immigration. Obviously, Democrats are going to want to talk about everything else but this attack. They're going to want to talk about extremism in general. You know, Republicans, they're predispositioned to talk about ISIS and foreign policy. The reality is the front line in this war is not in Raqqa, it's not in Tikrit or Mogadishu, where we send our troops to do God knows what. It's in communities such as Paterson, New Jersey, Brooklyn, New York, Minneapolis, Dearborn. We have the problem in the country because we let the problem in, as we see. This is a 29-year-old immigrant from Uzbekistan. And again, you know, a lot of times people politicize certain events, certain tragedies, and they don't have much to do with a public policy outcome. But in this case, it has everything to do with it because immigration is an elective policy. We have problems in our own country. We're going to always have problems among our own population. But the fact that we are bringing in people in record numbers from these countries after 9/11, despite the ubiquitous nature of jihad in these areas, is just simply suicidal. Frank, I don't know what it's going to take to get our political leaders to finally shut this off.
I don't either, but one of the things I know is a contributing factor is our not-so-political and yet very political judiciary. When you ask the question of what we're going to need to do to shake up the political class here, one obvious step, it seems to me, is to ensure that we have the freedom to speak about these issues, to actually challenge the orthodoxy or the political correctness or whatever you want to call it, the submission, as I was just talking about with Dinah West. But one of the other forces that is very clearly operating here in so many different areas, but specifically on this immigration question, as you know so well, is the federal judiciary. And I'd like you to talk about, as I mentioned, your thesis in Stolen Sovereignty that we actually have unelected and therefore unaccountable judges transforming America. Talk about it in the context, Daniel, of what's been going on with President Trump's immigration pause executive orders.
It's amazing. If you think about it, after an event like this, and again, I never think public policy should be driven by one event solely. This is a broad trend, a growing problem. Like I said, you know, immigration from the Middle East is the fastest growing subset. It's not just a debate over, well, whether we let in some or none. This is the fastest growing trend in immigration. So any sane president would say, all right, well, we're going to end the diversity visa lottery, which is just insane policy, even outside of national security concerns. And we're going to ratchet down immigration from countries that have a lot of Islamic terrorists. Guess what? At present, right now, despite the Supreme Court's ruling, one federal district judge has the ability to stop a president from evidently denying a single visa to someone from like a country such as Uzbekistan. I mean, Judge Watson from Hawaii has an injunction in place that's functioning right now. The courts have done to immigration in the past year what they've done to marriage and life and many other issues that they should have no jurisdiction over. This is a political issue. It's Congress has full power over it, and the president has Article 2 national security powers over this. It is amazing how we've allowed lower courts that are a creation of Congress, not the Constitution, to run roughshod over everything the president wants to do. Congress could end their jurisdiction over this tomorrow. Congress could defund visas from these countries tomorrow. And I think the president needs to take his tweets to the next level and actually demand these policy changes.
Let me ask you, Daniel, because you raised such an important point there. The Supreme Court did seem to slap down this particular federal judge, among others in the federal judiciary, over this precise overreach. So how is it he is able to still be doing it? And again, on a nationwide injunction.
Exactly. And by the way, the first case with the Supreme Court, that was the stronger order. The one that Judge Watson went and placed the nationwide injunction on last week was actually a weaker version. And yes, I mean, nationwide injunctions, the notion that a district judge could just declare something outside of an individual case or controversy inside his geographical jurisdiction, that is completely made up. That is what distinguishes the judicial power from a legislative or executive veto power. This is literally a system of government we did not adopt. It's made up. And I think also you identified one factor in why I believe the judiciary is irremediably broken, and we're never going to fix it by simply appointing Republican judges. We have to systemically reform its jurisdiction, among other things, because they don't respect precedent even from 3 minutes ago. You know, so basically, this is a perfect case study. For 200 years, the court said that immigration is inherent in sovereignty, and the political branches have to decide that the court cannot grant standing to foreign nationals to sue for any rights to come here. Right now, they're creating rights to come here to have an abortion, to have driver's licenses. But once a court breaks it one time, they'll say that that's precedent. See, progressives believe that what they're doing is the moral thing. It's the right thing. So you could always be more moral than the Supreme Court, but you can't be less moral.
Where is the court itself, the Supreme Court, in all of this? It does seem as though they've got a vested interest as well as a constitutional duty to ensure that the lesser courts are conforming, do they not? Or is this really up to Congress to try to simply defund these guys?
The Supreme Court's a joke. I mean, it's one directional. You bet your bottom dollar that if a conservative judge were doing something like this, it would be struck down in 3 seconds. You know, it's political. They allow the lower courts to be their forward guard to start advancing the ball. They don't want to do it so blatantly, but they allow the lower courts to stand. They take a long time to address it. They often never address it. Or even when they do a split the baby type of decision and entertain completely illegitimate arguments. So this is a huge problem. Unless the other two branches say this is illegitimate and step on the playing field and use their co-equal and stronger powers to push back against the courts, I fear that we have no country left, because we now have to submit before a lower court the national security rationale for cutting off a single visa.
It's unbelievable. It is, in fact, as you've called it, the transformation of America, Daniel Horowitz, and something that I believe you're completely correct, especially if the Supreme Court is not going to impose any discipline and living up to their own precedents, as you say, then it does behoove the president and the Congress to step in. Daniel, there's so much more to talk about on this. I'd hope that we would get to another judge's interposing her views on the commander-in-chief's authority concerning the makeup of the United States military, but that will be for another day. Thank you so much for your time and for the great work that you do at Conservative Review. Please, folks, check out Daniel's really path-breaking book, Stolen Sovereignty, How to Stop Unelected Judges from Transforming America. Daniel, we'll talk to you again very soon. Next up, we'll have Admiral James Ace Lyons to talk about the attack of yesterday and more generally what we're up against and also the president's trip to Asia right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. It's with the greatest of pleasure, I have to say, and distinct privilege that I'm able to welcome once again to our microphones a man I've come to admire hugely for his service to our country in so many different capacities, including for some 36 years in the uniform of the United States Navy. He rose through the ranks from an able-bodied seaman to the Commander-in-Chief of the U.S. Pacific Fleet, a four-star Admiral Billet. I'm talking, of course, about the great James Ace Lyons. He is these days the president of Lyons Associates. He is also the chairman, I'm very, very proud to say, of the Center for Security Policy's Military Committee. Mr. Chairman, Admiral, welcome back. It's so good to have you.
Nice to be with you, Frank, and your listeners.
Thank you. Listen, I just want very quickly to touch base with you, sir, on your thoughts about yesterday's latest outrage in New York City, the jihadist attack there. I talked earlier in the program with our mutual friend Diana West about the inadvisability of these enemies perceiving us as submitting to them. You've given a lot of thought, had a lot of hard experience with these characters. Your take on all of that?
You're spot on. And, you know, here, the core of this thing goes back to Senator Chuckie Schumer's visa diversity program that he sponsored. Like, we need to bring in more of these questionable people into our society. Makes absolutely no sense. I mean, restricting the influx of Muslims into this country is spot on, and that's what we should be supporting the president on this program.
At least unless we can determine that they are not in any way, shape, or form Sharia supremacists and seeking to bring that here. You know, Admiral, this diversity lottery has been called, a lottery, for starters. It seems to me it's closer to Russian roulette because we seem to have no idea what these folks really have in mind other than that they're diverse. And as you say, it makes no sense. Let me ask you about Iran as an example of a Sharia supremacist operation that has been greatly emboldened of late by President Obama, most especially. I'll be talking shortly with Mark Schneider about sort of the growing nuclear threats from all quarters. But what do you make, Admiral Lyons, of the current posture and increasing capabilities of the Iranian, not just with respect to ballistic missiles and perhaps nuclear weapons, but their regional ambition, notably what has just gone down with the Kurds?
Well, I had an op-ed ran yesterday on this, and the title of it was Trumped Again by Iran. And here we sold out our only staunch ally in the fight against ISIS, the Kurdistan desires for independence. And it's more than independence, because this was key to blocking the Iranian hegemonic objectives of establishing a land bridge that runs from Tehran through Iraq, Syria, into Lebanon, where they'll be right on the border of Israel and can threaten their actual existence. We sold them out. This I attribute to the Obama holdovers in the State Department, the NSC staff, a compromised National Security Team, and as I said in my op-ed, they all must be replaced.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more, sir. And particularly to hear H.R. McMaster, the National Security Advisor, belatedly professing concern about what the Iranians and Iraqis were doing to the Kurds after they had essentially been sold out, is, to put a fine point on it, outrageous to my way of thinking. So speaking about outrageous, I spoke a moment ago with Daniel Horowitz about judicial tyranny. I wanted to get your reading on this judge in the district court here in Washington, D.C., ruling that the president actually doesn't have the authority to determine who can be in the United States military, specifically overturning his decision not to allow transgender individuals to serve. Your thoughts on that, sir?
This is total nonsense. The military has one purpose. It is to protect and defend this great Constitution and our country. Anything that distracts and disturbs the good order and discipline must be rejected. It is the military, the Defense Department, that sets the standards. Nobody has a right to serve in the military. We set the standards that we must have the best possible people available to protect our freedoms and democracy. This transgender thing, Dr. Phil McHugh, the lead psychologist from Johns Hopkins University, has studied this for years, clearly stated, this is a mental disorder. It needs treatment and understanding. It should never be forced on the military. This is not a civil right. And to think that you're going to have changed sex by operations is pure nonsense. I'm just about quoting him.
This is something that you've obviously had to reckon with in the course of commanding ships and fleets, for that matter, is the impact that people who have medical conditions or, for example, are pregnant, what that means for the readiness of the ships to which they are assigned, and more generally, the units and their preparedness for combat. I mean, this is the triumph of political, not just correctness, but priorities over the most fundamental role of the military, as you say, sir.
Let me add, please, these people are mentally unstable. This is not what you want aboard your ship or leading your men into combat. And certainly I would hope the Trump administration will take it all the way to the Supreme Court if necessary. It has done nothing to improve our readiness and capabilities. It has destroyed unit integrity, cohesiveness, and the will to win. And, of course, that was the objective. And what I don't understand is why the secret Presidential Study Directive 11 has not been canceled. And that's part of the problem as well, which commits this great country to embracing the likes of the Muslim Brotherhood, which is out to destroy not only our country, our Constitution, but our entire way of life.
Admiral, this is a subject for another day. I did want to touch, before we run out of time with you, on one other issue. Having served with great distinction in the Far East, commanding our Pacific Fleet, I wondered what your thoughts are as the president prepares to travel to that region. He'll be visiting five nations, I believe, starting with Communist China, whose leader has just evidently consolidated power and seems to have a very aggressive agenda at odds with our vital national security interests. What do you think will come of that meeting between the two, Xi Jinping and Donald Trump, and what else should we be doing in the region at the moment, sir?
Well, first of all, of course, the key element right now is the North Korean nuclear program. And certainly President Trump has to make it very plain to President Xi Jinping that there'd be no North Korea nuclear program problem if it wasn't for China and Russia. It is China that has provided the wherewithal, the means, the mobile facilities, what the TELs we call them, tractor erector launches, that is giving the North Koreans the ability to be able to move these strategic missiles around the country and make it difficult for us to target. So the first thing I want to see him to do is demand that China take back those 10 TELs that they have provided to North Korea. The second most important thing for the president to do is reinforce our alliances and with our allies and friends in the region and make it very, very plain to the Chinese president that we will not be intimidated, we will not withdraw, we will meet our treaty commitments. And he has to back that up by repositioning forces and so forth to build up our capabilities out there.
We mentioned yesterday your recommendation that he also reposition American dependents out of South Korea, which is a step that we very much strongly endorse. Admiral Lyons, we have to leave it at that for the moment. There's so much more to talk with you about. I look forward to doing so again in the very near future. Thank you for your time today, though, sir, and for your extraordinary service to our country, including that you continue to render at the Center for Security Policy's Military Committee. God bless you. We'll talk next with Mark Schneider. We'll get a sense of the nuclear dimensions of the challenges that we're facing, particularly from Russia. What we better be doing about them right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. It's a very, very great delight to me to say, joined by Dr. Mark Schneider, the man I've had the privilege of knowing and working with over the years and have come to appreciate as one of the great public servants, mostly unsung for his service in our Defense Department, our State Department, and to the country more generally. He was for many years a senior official in the Office of the Secretary of Defense. That's where we first crossed paths a lifetime ago in the Reagan administration. He's gone on to serve in a number of other capacities with great distinction. These days, he is a senior analyst with the highly acclaimed National Institute for Public Policy and one of the country's real corporate memory experts, duty experts on nuclear forces and arms control related issues. Mark Schneider, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Great to have you.
Well, thank you very much for that kind introduction.
Well, it's heartfelt and well-deserved. Let me ask you about several things, Mark, quickly, just as sort of scene setting for a conversation about what we need to do with respect to our own nuclear deterrent posture at the moment. There's a report out that there has been a collapse of a tunnel in the nuclear test site in North Korea, evidence that they're continuing to beaver away with improving their nuclear capabilities. There's also been a report, well, not a report, but much ballyhooed strategic exercise in the Russian Federation, presided over by none other than Vladimir Putin himself. Talk about the sort of threat environment as you see it at the moment, Mark Schneider.
Well, both of, not the tunnel collapse. It's a setback for the North Koreans, but it's not a big one. I mean, they could basically just find another mountain and start digging in it. But certainly the strategic exercise of last week is a major threat development because it really is Vladimir Putin nuking Donald Trump. I expected the exercise to happen, but I didn't expect it to be announced by the Kremlin with full court press on the fact that Putin presided over it and
personally launched some missiles, as I understand it.
Yes, they said that he personally gave the launch order. Now, all these things were strategic systems, intercontinental range systems, and the only possible subject for that sort of attack is the United States. The unusual aspect of this one is it didn't involve an escalation scenario, but just Russian launches.
A bolt from the blue, perhaps, as they say.
Yeah, I mean, it could have been. I mean, there's no indication one way or the other, but they put out nothing about the scenario, and it looks like, you know, a full scale simulation of a full scale attack on the United States. They were coordinating the launches of an ICBM and three submarine launched ballistic missiles. These missiles flew to intercontinental range, so we're the only, you know, possible target. And the fact that that's going on during the nuclear posture review, I think, is clear message sending.
Well, let me talk to you about that, because I'm very keen to get your latest assessment of what's happening in this internal interagency review by the United States government. It's a quadrennial enterprise, usually in the first year of a new administration. I think we get a flavor of what they have in mind. What are you hearing about this so-called nuclear posture review, or NPR, Mark?
I mean, there have been some favorable reports about what is going to be recommended. Matter of fact, the recommendations are those that I've made within the last year or two. So I'm pleased that at that aspect, that includes giving us a low-yield deterrent capability against low-yield Russian attack, which would be the first thing they do if Putin decides to launch a nuclear war. There's reports of bringing back the Tomahawk nuclear submarine-launched cruise missile, which is a very useful development.
And both of these are things that could be done reasonably quickly, as I understand it. Is that right, Mark?
Yes, almost instantaneously in those two instances. It would be very easy and very rapid. And they're very useful developments. And a recent report talked about abandoning the Obama nuclear doctrine and coming back to, you know, something that makes some sense for a change.
That nuclear doctrine being, I call it... ridding the world of nuclear weapons, starting with ours.
Well, sort of, yeah. I mean, he doesn't say that, but he did enormous damage to the overall U.S. nuclear posture and the overall U.S. military posture across the board. I mean, he left the U.S. military literally on the verge of collapse, and that's now being reversed. So that's good news. Now, what I'm worried about is whether or not, and I have no inside information on this, but whether or not we do what is necessary to prevent the collapse of our nuclear deterrent in the next 10 to 25 years. Two things have to be done, and done very quickly. One is restoring tritium, which is a key component of our nuclear weapons.
Our ability to produce it, you mean?
Yes. Because if we don't do that, starting maybe 5 years from now, we're going to lose 5% of our nuclear arsenal every year. The other thing, and I think this is even worse in the long term, is we've lost almost completely our ability to produce a key component of even life-extended nuclear weapons, which is the fissile material pit. And the Russians have a production capability of at least 1,000 a year. Since the Rocky Flats plant was terminated or put out of production in the late 1980s, we've produced 39 nuclear pits, according to a Los Alamos National Laboratory.
Basically hand-building them out there, is that right?
Yes. Well, we're not even hand-building them because the last U.S. nuclear pit was built in 2009. In other words, the whole Obama administration didn't build any, period. If we don't do anything about this, the estimated life of a U.S. pit is 45 to 60 years, and according to the Los Alamos publication, the average age of a pit is now over 35 years. So we've got 10 to 25 years, and after that, at some point in that time period, you see a collapse of the U.S. nuclear deterrent unless we restore a serious capability.
Particularly with the combined effect of that and the half-life of tritium kicking in and taking down these...
We lose over 5% every year. There's nothing you can do about that other than producing any more. And Obama left us with a complete inability to produce tritium.
Mark Schneider, just to sort of summarize and bring this up to the moment, this is deeply troubling. Needless to say, people like you and I and the Center for Security Policy and others have been in the National Institute for Public Policy, which you work at, has been very active in trying to raise alarms about this malign neglect. It's not even benign, malign neglect of our nuclear deterrent posture, which I think, frankly, can be laid at the feet of other administrations to some extent as well. But this administration, the Trump administration, has made it very clear, at least at the rhetorical level, in the person of the vice president most recently, that they're determined to resuscitate our nuclear deterrent capabilities and regard it as the single most important thing we can do to maintain peace in the world. Do you anticipate, coming out of this NPR, that there will be action commensurate with that rhetorical commitment?
Well, I hope so. As I say, I have no inside information, but I suspect, we are going to get some significant improvements over the Obama program. Whether you get them through Congress, whether I can't predict that, obviously, despite all the rhetoric about how terrible the Russians are from the Democrats when it comes to deterring the Russians, they're on the other side.
It does seem that way. And protecting us from them with missile defenses as well. Mark Schneider, there's so much more to talk about. I hope you'll come back and do a full hour with us sometime soon. This is all really important information to share, and we're so grateful to you for taking the time to do it. Thanks for the work you do at the National Institute for Public Policy, and I hope you'll come back to us very soon. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.